What a lovely Monday to come in here. Tigers are 3-0. We're headed in the right direction. We have Monday Night Football tonight. Good week two of football in the NFL. But it's September 16, 2024. Welcome into the Gabe Kuhn Show. I am your host, former Memphis Tiger offensive lineman, Gabe Kuhn on X at G_Kuhn71. I'm alongside, as always, the executive producer of the show. That's Connor Dunning on X at CDunning929. Connor, how you doing?
I'm doing great.
Good to hear. Good to hear. Now, we have 3 hours of talk on the way, courtesy of 92.9 FM, ESPN, and yours truly. Don't want to waste too much time. Going to run down the show real quick. 5 o'clock, David Cobble joined from CBS Sports. We'll talk about where the Tigers are in the national scene. We talked to David on Friday, and what I asked him sort of about Memphis, and if they win this game against Florida State, will they be in the driver's seat in the group of five? He said yes. We'll get his opinion on that and how that's going to look the rest of the year. 6 o'clock, Harold Grader will join the show, the associate executive director of the AutoZone Liberty Bowl. We'll talk to him about that game and the rest of college football in general. Arch Manning had a good showing for Texas. Georgia came down to the wire against Kentucky. I think we need to have a conversation about officiating as well. What did you think, Connor? Not great? Not great.
Oh, bad.
Officiating
just
really
up bad.
In
really
college
bad.
Football. We'll hop into the Blitz at 6:30. Trip around the NFL at 5:30. But that'll do it for sort of running down the show. We have to talk about this Tigers dub. 20-12. They get over top in Doak Campbell Stadium against the Florida State Seminoles. Now, I understand that Florida State team is no good. I understand that. They've already lost to Georgia Tech. They lost to Boston College after getting absolutely run over by both of those teams. They're 0-3. They need to find answers. But anytime at the University of Memphis, when you play in the American Athletic Conference, that you have a chance to go on the road in that type of environment, which the fans didn't really turn out all that much. Memphis fans, the contingent looked pretty good. Mighty Sound of the South sounded good as well. But anytime you get to go on the road in that type of environment and go win a game, you have to appreciate it. You do. And I think Memphis fans have the right to be excited. There's a game going into this year that you expected to lose. You just hope they kept it competitive. It's an AP preseason top 10 team. They were number 10 in the country. I know some things have happened between now and then. But your Memphis Tigers win 20-12 on the road against what was the number 10 team in the first AP poll. That is something to be proud about. Now, what does the win mean going forward? It means they have more wiggle room the rest of the year. Now, sure, you hope that they run the rest of their schedule out and they go 13-0 and go to the college football playoff. But at this particular moment with that win over Florida State, having no blemish on their record, they have the opportunity to potentially lose one and still be where they want to be, to win the American Athletic Conference and to potentially get that college football playoff spot in the group of five. Now, some takeaways from the game. I want to start with Seth Hennigan. That was unbelievable poise on the road in that environment. Now, like the stats, I know he was AAC Offensive Player of the Week. I know he had a pick. But 25 for 38, decent efficiency, 272 yards, two TDs. He went in to Doak Campbell and was the better quarterback by miles. DJ, you couldn't do anything to keep up with Seth Hennigan on Saturday. And what was amazing to me is the ability he had on third down, and even in the first half when the defensive line for Florida State was bearing down on him a fair amount, he had the ability to place footballs. On some of the third and fourth down crunch time decisions, he was phenomenal. He executed at a very high level. He didn't put the ball in harm's way. The one pick was relatively fluky. You throw it out into the flat, and the Florida State guy just makes a good play. There's nothing you can really – it wasn't a great, you know, decision by Seth Hennigan, but I felt like his offensive player and the defensive player had about the same, you know, probability of catching that. And both the probabilities were low. Florida State just ends up with it. The ball to Rock Taylor in the second quarter that led to the scoring drive was perfect, beautiful, dropped it in a bucket. There was one on third down to Anthony Lanphier where he had to buy some time, and there was a linebacker standing on Anthony Lanphier's right shoulder, and he threw it perfectly. A bullet to his left shoulder gave Anthony Lanphier some runway, and that was to start the second half. That led them down the field to go score to start the second half to take that 20-3 lead that ended up being massive. So Seth Hennigan, you get the first star of the day. The other part of it, I have to give it up to the coaching staff. They in no way played to just stay in that game. They played to win that game. They didn't hold a damn thing back. You could argue about what they held back offensively. Maybe they didn't take too many shots down the field offensively. But the blitzing from Jordan Hankins late in that game brought 6 or 7 man pressures every single time because he saw DJU was bothered, and he kept going back to it. He brought 6 on the damn Hail Mary. That is unheard of. But he did it. He had balls of steel, and they end up getting through. The decision late in the game by Ryan Silverfield to go for it on 4th and 3, barely into Florida State's territory, when they had a chance, if they get that stop, to come back down the field, get the touchdown, get the 2-point conversion. That was ballsy. And what was great about that in particular, Tim Kramsey and Ryan Silverfield clearly had a conversation about, if we get into this 3rd or 4th and short type of situation, we're going to go to this play call. The little rollout from Seth Hennigan to Greg DeRosier. He had a great, great play, Greg DeRosier, to go get that first down. You bleed more clock off it. They played to win that game. They coached to win that game. That was very impressive to me. And then, of course, I think the biggest and most, you know, impressive part of this performance, the defense. 12 tackles for loss, 4 sacks, and they held Florida State to their lowest point total this entire season. Held them to 12. They didn't let DJU get anything. He had 1 big play down the field to Malik Benson. In the first half, at one point, he was 6 for 7 with a pick for 7 yards. The secondary held up. They got after the passer. They did not let Florida State, who has 4 returning offensive linemen from last year's team that went 13-0, they did not allow them to run the ball. 24 carries for Florida State for 37 yards, 1.5 average. This defense is for real. This defense is going to allow the offense to pace the game and play a lot more game-managing-like than they have been able to in the past. Chandler Martin is the defensive player of the week in the AAC. 8 tackles, 2.5 for loss, and the 1 sack at the end of the game that completely took Florida State out of it. DJU was very uncomfortable after that. You knew he wasn't going to go score after Chandler Martin was able to get that sack. This defense, Jordan Hankins, the defensive coordinator, they get the game ball. That was as impressive a performance I've seen from a Memphis defense since 2014, my first year playing at the University of Memphis, when we went to the Miami Beach Bowl and it was Tank Jakes and Charles Harris was our captain and Bobby McCain and Martin Effetti. You had some NFL players on that side of the ball. This defense has the ability to be the best defense in the American Athletic Conference. And we know with the offensive firepower that this team possesses, that means a whole lot.
It was a lesser FSU team. That is true.
Sure.
But Memphis went in there and punched them in the mouth in Tallahassee, took $1.3 million, and said thank you for the win. Controlled the game from the very beginning until the end. They controlled the entire game. And I don't think that that's what people expected. Yes, it was a lesser FSU team, but it is still a massive win for the Memphis Tigers, not only this year, but in the history of the Memphis Tigers.
And like, what it could potentially signal and indicate going through the rest of the schedule.
Well, like you said, it gives you some wiggle room, because before the season started, we all penciled in this as a loss. And we said, okay, keep it close. Well, they kept it close, and they punched them in the mouth, and they walked out with a win. And I was just so impressed by the offensive side of the football and the defensive side of the football. It felt like a complete game. That opening drive that they had in the second half.
Beautiful.
Surgical.
12 plays, 75
surgical,
yards.
Probably the best drive of the entire season.
Yep.
And like you said, they just knew what they wanted to do in every single situation. There were a few faulty moments, and yes, they should have probably won the game by more than they did. But at the end of the day, they took care of business in the biggest moments. And we have, you know, the last few years, I think that you kind of said this off air, there has been a bit of a nervousness when Memphis gets a lead, because we have seen Silverfield teams in the past kind of let those leads slip through their fingers and it gotten close at the end of the games. But it has felt like now that it has been a little bit since that has happened. So I was very, very pleased by Memphis's performance. And to be quite honest, if people want to do backflips about this game and have a parade over it, do it.
Excited.
It's such a big deal. And if you're out there right now being like, well, it's a bad FSU team, and well, Memphis should have won this, and well, Memphis is probably going to still win. Shut up. Shut up, you dork. You're a dork. If you are trying to rain on people's parade right now, you're a dork.
Yes.
Get a life.
This is a meaningful win. The most meaningful win, in my opinion, in Ryan Silverfield's tenure. The most meaningful.
Could be.
And I think as this season ages, we may look back at this win as more important than it looks even right this second.
Absolutely.
So because what it could indicate in and what it could end in is a potential college football playoff berth, which is unheard of in the history of Memphis football. It's just it is a time to be excited. I know I'm excited. But obviously there's other things that are going to be coming up here relatively soon, coming up this weekend against Navy. I'll talk about that in a second. I don't want to forget this because this was one of the most important parts of this entire game. Tigers are up 20-9 after the interception, and Florida State mounts a pretty dang good drive. They really did. They came down 16 plays, about 71 yards, and the Tigers were able to hold them on the goal line to a field goal.
Huge
down. On first down, they let Roydell Williams run for a negative 2 yards. They made DJU throw an incomplete pass on second down. Bryce Edmondson gets the sack, sets them up at the 7 yard line on third down, and then they have to go get that field goal. If Florida State gets a touchdown in that situation, we are looking at that game completely differently. It was impressive as hell. And one thing I did have concerns about was this defensive line, right? I thought the front seven would be okay because these linebackers are great. We've seen Elijah Herring be a player of the week in the AAC for the defensive side. Chandler Martin got it this week, so we knew these linebackers would be good. I was wondering about this defensive line. Are they going to be good? They were phenomenal. They got after DJU just as well as the linebackers did. They got home with three at times, got pressure on DJU with just three rushers. And when it came to the run game, they were in the backfield at will against a pretty damn experienced Florida State offensive line. As bad as they have played, they're very experienced in their big bodies. And Memphis's defensive line, they seem well coached. They seem to understand the scheme. And they played with a physicality that we haven't seen from a defensive front since, I'll go back again, to 2014, the Miami Beach Bowl year.
Yeah, listen, DJU might suck, but the rest of that team doesn't. The rest of that team doesn't. They're highly touted recruits and transfer portal guys. That is why people were high on Florida State. DJU stinks. We can all agree on that.
Sure.
But the Memphis defensive line still pushed around a very good offensive line for Florida State.
Yep.
They were just better than them. I think that's the thing. Memphis was just better. They were better coaching.
That's another
They were better
part
offensively.
Of this.
They were better defensively. They were just better.
If I was going to, like, with a group of five team playing against one of the probably top 15 brands in the history of college football, you usually see some fluky things in a win for that group of five team. There was nothing fluky about that win. The fluky part of the game probably came from Florida State. A deep ball to Malik Benson, the only positive great pass play they had the whole day. And then you had the pick that sort of changed the game for them for a moment. All of the fluky things about that game in particular came from the Power Four side, came from that top 15 program. University of Memphis, nothing fluky. They played with physicality. They took care of the football. And they used the clock to their advantage.
They were physical.
It was very impressive. It was impressive to me.
And they shook them. And you could tell, we talked about it last week. One of your keys to the game was try to demoralize this team early. As soon as they hit them and got that fumble, you saw those shoulders sink for Florida State. And they were playing
by
on
the
their
way,
back feet.
Great play by Andarius Coffey, who's been trying to find a role. He's been trying to find a role on this team forever. He played running back and slot receiver, and he had a couple of major injuries, but he has stuck it out. He's a fifth-year senior, gets the strong safety spot this year, makes that type of play in that type of game. That's impressive stuff, and that does show a relative amount of culture. This is a guy who's been around for a while, who finally gets his opportunity and makes the most of it. That was very impressive to start that game. But overall, great win for the Memphis Tigers. And now you're going to set yourself up for a Navy game. And I will say this. This is the truth of it. And I hope this is being preached behind closed doors to that Tiger team. This is the perfect letdown spot.
100%.
Perfectly. I mean, on the road.
I'm terrified.
In gray and nasty Annapolis. With a 2-0 Navy team who has done a little bit, they run the triple option, but they do some of that spread option stuff. They get into shotgun a little bit more. It's a little bit of a different look. You're coming off the emotional high. They had a bye week, by the way. Navy just had a bye week. This is the perfect letdown spot for the University of Memphis.
It's the game before the season. I circled. I would say this is the biggest trap game of trap games.
Yes.
Like if you win against Florida State, the come down against going to Navy, cold, rainy option.
But here's the truth of it.
Just annoying as hell. And they have a bye week.
Here's the truth of it. I think that that's being preached very heavily behind closed doors. I'd be surprised if it wasn't the first thing they talked about in their team meeting today.
Well, especially considering Ryan Silverfield was part of staffs that lost those big games to Navy.
Sure, sure. And I will say, too, I look at the way that Memphis has defended the triple option and defended Navy, and I know it's a different wrinkle this year because they're going to be in more shotgun, maybe a little bit different of a look, and they may have a couple of more explosive athletes. But even when it was Matt Barnes or Mike McIntyre, it feels like the University of Memphis has gotten to the point where they are comfortable defending that triple option look.
Man, Barnes had a tough weekend, didn't he?
Yeah, he did with Mississippi State. Yeah.
Oof.
Isn't he just a DB? He's co-D coordinator. He's co-D coordinator. But 41-17 to Toledo, will tell you. I mean, it was a good week for Group of Fives. UNLV over Kansas, Toledo over Mississippi State, probably the most impressive Group of Five win of the week. 41-17 is pretty damn impressive. So, I do think Memphis is in the driver's seat, but there are other teams that definitely have an opportunity, more than we thought, right? Like, UTSA was in the conversation, throw them out now, and you have a couple of other teams, Toledo, NIU, and UNLV, that you weren't even thinking about.
NIU's the
big one. It's going to be very competitive down the stretch of the season to see who gets that spot.
You really need
that conference. But there are a lot more teams that are involved in this conversation than we originally.
You really need that conference just to eat itself alive.
I mean, because we really did the whole three-horse race, right? Boise State, Memphis, Liberty.
I think it was fair to say that. I think that was fair to say that that was the three, because we didn't expect NIU to go in and beat Notre Dame.
No, not at all.
If you had picked that before the season, I would have called you a lunatic.
And then Notre Dame responds with 66 points against Purdue.
Of course they did.
What the hell was that? Where was that last week? Good God. Just insane stuff. But the Group of Five is going to be has a lot of parity, a lot more competitive than we thought going into
Absolutely. But
there's
I do think it is very true that Memphis, you now control your own destiny.
Yes.
This win puts you in the driver's seat. Every single expert of college football says, nope, Memphis is at the top of the list now because they're undefeated.
And you should be favored. You should be favored in nearly every single last one of your games.
We'll see
what South Florida looks like. That'll be an interesting line because it, again, is on the road. And then Tulane, we'll see what that looks like on the road. But even on the road, I think this Memphis team in particular will probably be a slight favorite, a 1.5-point favorite, maybe a pick 'em, but you're going to be favored in 99.9% of the rest of your games. We'll see how it plays out, though.
Now, I know we're doing backflips and we're celebrating the win because it was so big. Because in my opinion, I truly do think that if they make the college football playoff, you could argue this is the biggest win in Memphis history. Right now, I don't think it's the biggest.
No.
I would still put game day in front of it and maybe an Ole Miss one or here and there, but it has the potential to be. That being said, were there any negatives that you took away from the game? Are you concerned about the run offensively? Because they weren't able to.
And
they still haven't really been able to put
that
together.
That's the other part of it. They have the ability to do it. I thought Florida State's defensive front and front seven played relatively well,
mm-hmm.
So I'll give them credit for that. I'm not fully concerned about it. I think against some of the better defensive fronts that you'll see, maybe Tulane probably the only one I'm looking at the rest of the schedule. Navy may be a little bit tough. I think you'll be able to run against most of the teams in conference the rest of the way. Middle Tennessee you'll be able to run against. Tulane's the only one really left that scares me. But even with that, I don't know if you noticed this, and this goes back to the fluky conversation where it wasn't fluky at all for the University of Memphis. Usually in those games, against a program like that, with the talented bodies that they have, the first half you struggle. And I thought Memphis's offensive line struggled. They got pushed around pretty good that entire first half. Second half, you usually see them sort of fade even more because they're demoralized after that first half. I thought they picked it up after the first half. They protected Seth well, and they actually had a couple of decent run plays. And I think also looking at Greg DeRosier,
probably
give him a couple of more carries during the game because he has a good change of pace. Mario, we know, can get downhill and fall forward for the most part. I think Greg DeRosier needs to be utilized a lot more in the run game. They're trying to scheme him into open space, give him some flat routes, give him some screen plays. That's what they're doing right now. Running him a little bit more, maybe off tackle, can be very, very solid for this team going forward.
Man, him taking that hit and staying on his feet and getting across to get that first down, one of the plays of the season, probably.
Well, and then the touchdown, too.
He took a... Dude, he got destroyed on that. I was also really impressed with the offense of how they use the tight ends. I felt like Memphis, I feel like I haven't really seen that from Memphis in the past. Their tight ends were all over the place.
Yeah. The only drawback I do have from that whole game, that fourth down that ultimately gave Florida State the ball back, where Anthony Lanfear dropped that. That was a perfect play by Tim Kramsey.
Hey, he
schemed up really well. He sure did. Schemed up very well, and he dropped it. And it's just like that. That could have been the nail in the coffin early, but he didn't. He didn't catch it, and obviously.
And listen, I know they only had two catches, but those sure hands of Rock Taylor,
yeah,
such a big deal. Getting like some big plays every once in a while because he had two catches, 25 yards each.
In my opinion, most meaningful catch of the game.
Huge.
From the University of Memphis on the throw. I understand the throw was great, but you know, catching it on the back end of that, setting them up in the red zone to ultimately go get a touchdown to put them up 10-0. That was the most important pass play of the game.
Every single time Memphis had to make a play, they did.
Yep.
Every single time, and they executed. And we haven't even talked about the MVP of the game yet. Colby Cox. What a man.
Shout out to our research assistant and intern.
Colby Cox.
Oh, my gosh.
What a hero.
Florida State fumbles it.
Top awareness for a reason.
They had a punt. They muffed a punt, and there's Colby Cox picking up the ball. He was hyped up. Yeah. We do need to talk to him. What do we think about the eye black? Do we like his eye black?
Let him live.
Okay.
Let him live.
Okay, I understand it.
Looks like a warrior.
He's a warrior.
He probably scared the Florida State player because they saw that eye black and said, "That ball's yours."
Where does Florida State go from here? That's the real question.
You've got to make a quarterback change.
You got
to
do something.
You have to. Let me ask you a serious question. Is there any benefit to playing DJU the rest of the season? Seriously.
You just toss me an absolute softball. Absolutely not. There's no reason to
play. There's no reason.
He hasn't shown any ability to run Norvell's system. And here's the other part about
it. He panics so fast.
Here's the other part about it. He is a super senior. There is no future for him at Florida State University. There's no future for him. They're already 0-3. They're just trying to save themselves, maybe get to a bowl game, but that's going to be really hard. If you look at the rest of their schedule, the only gimme is Charleston Southern. I mean, they're going to Cal next week.
God, they better win that game.
They're dealing with Cal next week. Do you think they'll win that game, no doubt? No. No one can...
I hope so.
I sure you hope so, but I just don't see that game necessarily going their direction. I don't see any reason you keep DJU in there. There's no future for him there. You have two guys sitting behind him that were four-star recruits, Luke Cromenhoek and Brock Glenn, of course, from Covington, who ultimately went to Lausanne here in town. Play one of those guys. At least I don't even know if those guys are going to be the future of your program. You may go recruit a transfer portal recruit at the quarterback position, pay him a whole bunch of money. But at the same time, those guys have a better chance of being the future of your program at the quarterback position than DJU does because he's going to be gone after this year, and he hasn't shown you anything of note. And what he has shown you is when you bring pressure after him, which that's the book on him right now, he will fold under that pressure, throw picks, and make mistakes. There's no reason to play him the rest of the year. And when you look through the rest of their schedule, I just want to talk about that really quick. Like the rest of their schedule, let me pull it up really fast. May not be as fast as I originally thought. But they have Cal, I know, coming up here soon.
I got
then it. Then SMU on the road, Clemson at home, Duke on the road, Miami on the road, North Carolina at home, on the road at Notre Dame, Charleston Southern second to last game of the year, and then Florida. I just look at the schedule and I think a 3-9, 2-10 season is very much on the table for the team.
Oh no,
that's what it feels like to me.
What do you make about the conversations around Mike Norvell?
Listen, I think last year he lost. We talked about this a little last week too. He lost 10 guys to the NFL draft. He has 10 guys that he lost to the NFL draft. He had to go replenish his team, and he didn't necessarily have a bunch of guys that he recruited from the high school ranks ready to go. So when you have 10 guys to replace, 10 starters that were of NFL caliber, you have to use your NIL money and spread it out. And I still don't think there's any coincidence that he got DJU. Cam Ward was asking for upwards of $1.5 million to $2 million. He couldn't take that out of his budget and give it directly to Cam Ward because he had too many holes to sort of fill. So he spread it out, took DJU on a relative budget move, and you end up with what you end up with, and you strike out sometimes. I don't think at all this year should define him. What I think it has showed us, though, and I think Memphis showed us this as well, because, you know, outside of the Cotton Bowl year, it was 8-5, 8-6, We had a 10-3 year, things like that. He's a window coach. And by what I mean by that is he'll take the transfer portal and his high school recruits and build them up. He'll get to a 2-year window where he feels like he can really compete on the national stage. Once those guys leave, he's going to have to replenish and he's going to have to build up for another window. I don't know if he has the ability right now, this year shows it, to sustain the ability that he had to win 13 games in the regular season last year. I don't know if he has the sustainability that a lot of the greatest coaches in America have. I don't think he should be defined off this year, but the truth of the matter is, no one's going to look past a 2-10 or 3-9 season. You can't. You're at Florida State. That's unacceptable. So he better get this window going quick. He better attack the transfer portal this offseason. He better find some guys that he really trusts this offseason. Or it could be nasty for him. Because I think after this season, if it goes the way I think, which is 3-9, I think bottom basement 2-10, peak probably what, 4-8, 5-7, sort of what we're looking at. I think he's going to be on the hot seat. But this offseason can be very defining for him.
Man, I can't believe how bad DJU is. Just watching that game, my main thought was this guy has no shot to win this game. He makes, and I get why he's tricked so many people.
He makes easy.
Because on that 67-yarder, you were like, oh, there it is.
And Noah does.
And then it just disappears.
Noah stinks for him, though, too. Two crucial drops in that game.
Huge.
One for a first down on third down, and another one, Mike Norvell called the perfect screen.
Wide
in
open.
The perfect situation.
Wide open.
Probably a touchdown. And just bobbled and dropped by the running back coming out of the backfield.
It is very funny to me that there is more than one photo of a Florida State receiver with his head just on the field. Just like face mask down.
Malik Benson at the end of that game.
Yeah.
But you know who can save him from all these drops and this luck that he's running into? 3-2-1 Noel.
He has to do it, right?
Red Solo cup full of dog poo.
It's the curse.
He needs to go to just one spoonful out and you'll break the curse. Somebody's going to have to do it. Somebody is going to have to, you know, there's going to have to be some concessions made by somebody because 3-2-1 Noel started this curse. He's got to end it. He's got to do something. But do we have the sound?
We do.
This is literally about as perfect a omen, I guess is the best way to put it, for what Mike Norvell has seen with his Florida State team through the first three games of the year. He was in his press conference on the other side of the stadium from where Ryan Silverfield was, and just go ahead and give it a listen. The stadium's on fire! The program is on fire!
It is literally...
The fire alarm went off!
It is quite literally the nothing to see here meme, and then everything's exploding behind
That's
him.
That's exactly what it
and
is.
And it's even funnier that he just tries to talk right through it as
what,
if it's what not
would you
going
do,
on.
What would you do if you're him? I don't know. I just want to get through it.
It is funny, though, because when you watch the video, as soon as it goes off, his eyes
get
so wide. He's like, you've got to be effing kidding me. Did DJ's dumbass do that?
Yeah.
You know, he probably hates DJU with the fires of a thousand suns.
It's just that right there was the perfect, I mean, it's exactly what needed to happen after that particular game. You're 0-2 in conference, you're 0-3 overall, and you're heading into the toughest part of your schedule. And you just have no hope. And now the Florida State fans are crashing in on you.
And you just got beat by the team.
And I know
that you used
Ryan,
to coach.
Ryan will take the political approach to the whole thing. And he has, and I think he's done a good job of it. That meant a whole lot to him.
Yes, it did.
Don't play yourself. Don't try to act like it was just all fun and games. That meant a bunch to him. There is no doubt in my mind. Having worked under someone, reached to a certain height, that person leaves, you take over the program, you want to take it to new heights, you want to have your name stamped. All that has happened since Mike Norvell left and Ryan took over is everyone compares him to Mike. Everyone wants to compare him. Well, he won the head-to-head battle. He got over top of that guy. That means something to him. And then the final conversation I want to have real quick is with Ryan Silverfield. We've had some people lukewarm on him throughout his tenure. How much has that changed after that win? You have the Liberty Bowl. You got that win. but people could chalk it up to it's a bowl game, whatever, who cares? Even though I disagree with that sentiment altogether, Iowa State cared about that game. Then you start this season 3-0 with a win over Florida State, and you make $1.3 million. Now you are in the driver's seat in the group of five to potentially do something special that's never been done here at the University of Memphis. Are there people that are still lukewarm? Or is everybody sort of right there in his corner now? I think he stamped himself as, I am the Memphis football coach. There is a respect factor now with what I've been able to accomplish. Is everybody there? Or are there still some people holding out? That's my question.
He's got a couple big wins now. He really does. He's got a couple of them. His teams show up. And, you know, Seth Hennigan talked about this a lot. He talked about it after the game, before the game. The continuity that Memphis has been able to sustain during the era of NIL is so impressive. And a big part of that is Ryan Silverfield and the players believing in him and the relationship that he has with them.
You look across the sideline at how badly that could go. You look across the sideline at trying to replenish through the transfer portal.
Flip quarterbacks. What happens in that game?
Right. Right.
Flip quarterbacks. What happens?
Memphis probably loses the ball game.
Probably.
There's no doubt about it. 100% loses that ball game. But I just, like, the continuity factor is massive, but you also see how badly it could go. And he sees a guy very close to him that he respects a whole lot on the other side that it's gone horribly for.
It also matters to not coach scared.
Yes.
And they certainly did not coach scared.
Some of these decisions, though, it's just like, dude.
They were some of, I heard Jeffrey talking about it earlier, and I fully agree with it. There was a listener out there that called in or tweeted in to the station during Jeff's show that said, like, I've already watched the game three times because I couldn't watch it live, and I've gone back to watch it. Dude, in those big moments, I was walking away from the television. I couldn't watch it. I was so nervous about what was going to happen. And then when you would hear, you know, good happen, okay, you run back to the TV and you rewind it, and you're like, great, because in the moment, I felt like I was about to pass out.
The fourth and three, though.
When he
that
was, like,
was the most
we're going
important
for
one.
It. I was like, but you're on the other side. You're on the wrong side of the field. I was like, Ryan, no. I was like, because
it's a one-score game.
All I could see in my head was the tweets. The tweets that would happen. Speaking
I think
of
the
coaching.
When it comes to decision-making, the only thing that you could really go after him for is the field goal attempt.
Sure.
From Caden Costa from 55, because the chances of that going through 20%, 25% maybe.
We trust
he had
kickers.
The distance, but he didn't get it. It was never going to be good. You could either, I guess some people were saying punt it, but I don't see punting it from that area of the field's weird. I thought if you're going to make any other decision besides kicking it there, you go for it.
Speaking of going for it, the most mind-boggling thing of the entire game was that two-point try by Florida State. Felt like they gave Memphis a ton of momentum and breathing room.
Because it would have been 20.
End of that game
it would have
been
20-11. It would have been 20-11 as opposed to 20-9. And if you just kick the field goal there, you're playing for 7 instead of 8.
Right.
It came back to put way more pressure on his team.
I just don't understand it.
I guess the idea at that point in the game, because you hadn't had anything going offensively, the only idea I could even is because you cannot in any way, shape, or form try to make that make sense through analytics. There's nothing analytic about it. There's nothing analytical about that decision. I think it just had to do with momentum and just trying to, but when you don't get the two, you defeat the momentum you just got by scoring.
Well, and you,
it was a very bizarre decision.
And you jack the momentum up for the team that already has it. It's like they gave Memphis a boost when that happened. Because they had just scored.
It's a 9-point game versus an 11-point game.
Right.
I didn't get it at all. It was very bizarre. The only thing that I could do to rationalize it, and I don't think it's a good rationalization, is maybe he just wanted to continue the momentum he got by scoring. But it's not that much. It's one extra point.
But you have DJU.
He'll kill the momentum
somehow.
Yeah.
What are you doing?
Yeah.
You trust that guy?
No, we need to go ahead and take our first break of the day. And when we come back, we'll talk about the rest of college football week 3. And I think there needs to be a point that we need to talk about. The officiating this weekend was miserable. I have a reason why that's the case, but I don't think it should be used as an excuse. But that's next, 92.9 FM ESPN. College football week 3 is in the rear view. We're moving on to week 4. Before I get to the negative, you know, part of this weekend, and that was just officiating around the country, do want to highlight a couple of things. Where I was right this weekend, first of all, Alabama rolled Wisconsin. Wasn't even close. Now, Wisconsin did lose Tyler Van Dyke, their starting quarterback, early in that game. Only completed 5 passes. Looks like he's going to be out for the year with a torn ACL, so that is really bad for Luke Fickell and company. But Bama was just dominant the whole way through. They had their left tackle, Caden Proctor, return. They ran the ball relatively well at a 5.3 average. Jalen Milroe, 14 carries for 75 yards, 2 TDs. 12 for 17 passing for 196 yards and 3 TDs. First 3 games of the year, he's accounted for 2 TDs rushing and 2 TDs passing in every single game. Pretty damn impressive from him. And I think when we talk about the Heisman shortlist, he's definitely up there. But that was one of the most obvious things of the weekend. I know people are going to talk about Camp Randall and the jump around and how that was all going to go, you know, going into a really tough environment. That environment did not bother Alabama in the slightest. And I know last week, you know, struggling with South Florida, there was a couple of people concerned. I don't think you should be concerned. And Jalen Milroe, if you watch that game, you would see what I have been trying to just bring home the entire offseason. He's got an elite deep ball. What Kalen DeBoer's been able to do to scheme guys open to use the deep ball that Jalen Milroe possesses is damn impressive. And it's going to help them down the stretch of the season, especially when they need to hit big shots against SEC opponents. Jalen Milroe, very impressive. That's where I wanted to start this thing. Now, moving on, we did have a pretty interesting game that took place in Gainesville. Texas A&M on the road against Florida, and A&M was down Connor Wegman. Marcel Reed steps in, 6'2", 180 freshman out of Nashville. I think he was a 4-star recruit. I look at him, and I sort of wonder, do you even go back to Connor Wegman? He ran the ball 13 carries, 83 yards for a touchdown, 11 for 17 passing, 178 yards, 2 touchdowns, didn't turn the ball over, and they embarrassed Florida on the road, 33-20, but it wasn't even that close. Florida had a late 6 points that made it look a little closer than it was. But that A&M team was very impressive. They ran the ball crazy, 55 carries for 310 yards for a 5.6 average. They only had 1 touchdown on the ground, though, but 310 yards rushing. That Florida team just looks decimated. They look, you know, completely, they don't have much focus. They look like they have no confidence, and they're getting run over. One thing that I thought about this team going into the year is, okay, maybe their skill positions aren't that great. We'll see what Graham Mertz looks like, that type of thing. But in the end of the day, I thought they'd be tough. I thought they'd be, you know, at least, you know, being able to compete along the lines of scrimmage. They got whooped on both sides. Absolutely whooped. Wasn't even close. And now you have to talk about Billy Napier. Billy Napier is a guy that was probably lead candidate on the hot seat coming into this year, especially with the back half of the schedule he's going to have. Once he gets to that Tennessee game in a couple of weeks, you're going to have at Tennessee, Kentucky, at Georgia, at Texas, LSU, Ole Miss, you end at Florida State. That's where we thought it would get really tough for him. It's already tough for him. It's brutal for him. He had to go at least 4-1 in these first 5 games to save his job, and he is 1-2. And what we have seen is already the Board of Trustees at Florida meet to talk about the future of Billy Napier at the University of Florida. And, you know, I know what Scott Strickland, their AD, said a couple of weeks ago. I expect Billy Napier to be here for long term. He's going to lead the Florida Gators into the promised land. That's not going to happen. It's just not going to happen. That team is not very well coached. They don't have an edge about them. And they don't have many redeeming qualities at this particular point. And it's only going to get worse from here. There's no chance they're going to make a bowl game. Who do they look to next? That's the next question. There's been some names brought up. But at the top of the list, everybody's talking about it, Lane Kiffin. Now, how do I feel about Lane Kiffin going to Florida? I get where he would. I understand the reasons that he would. He's familiar with the state of Florida. He's been there before. He's had some success. He knows how to recruit the state. It's still in the SEC. You get some more money. You have more NIL funds at your disposal. And honestly, when you look at Florida, when they're up, they're up. They're a sustainable program to have success at. I think Ole Miss right now is a window program, like I talked about with Mike Norvell. You build these guys up, and every 2 or 3 years, you're at the top of the SEC with a chance to either win it or potentially get to a college football playoff. At Florida, you could do it every year if you do it right. But I think the reasons he wouldn't go outweigh the reasons that he would. The reasons he wouldn't go: his daughter is going to Ole Miss. He has created a great environment at Ole Miss. He's recruiting at a high level at Ole Miss. He has more than enough NIL funds to recruit at Ole Miss. He's won at very high level at Ole Miss. The fans love him at Ole Miss. And then here's the biggest part of it that really sways me to think Lane may have to turn down that Florida job. He's taken those big jobs before. He's done it in the past. And I understand what you could say. You could say, well, he was younger. He didn't know how to, you know, manage his time and himself. He had struggles with alcohol, and he was, you know, not putting putting his best foot forward. But he's been at USC. He's been at Tennessee. He was left on the damn tarmac at Tennessee.
In the dark of the night.
He's seen how those big jobs can treat you. And they don't treat you the best if you're not winning 10 games a year. He sees he can go in down years, 7-5, 8-4, at Ole Miss, and they're fine. They feel cool about it. They still have hope for what he can achieve. You go to Florida, and you're 7-5, 8-4 a couple years in a row, they're asking for a change of leadership. So I think that's the biggest reason. He's seen what that looks like before. And I don't know if he's ready to hop into it at this point in his career. He is very, very comfortable at Ole Miss.
I just can't help but shake. If he didn't necessarily want Alabama, why would he want Florida? That's kind of where I come down on it. It's just everything that you just laid out, I think Ole Miss is kind of the perfect spot for him right now. And until one of those truly prestigious jobs come open again.
Florida fits that bill.
But it's been
a while.
It's been a while. And it's so destabilized right now. And he would just have to rebuild that entire program. And just to be quite honest, I don't think he wants to do that.
And also, how much time do they give you to rebuild that entire
program? Right. I just don't think he wants to do that. It's going to take a lot of effort.
Isn't that the biggest issue for coaches at this particular moment in time? If you're making, because he probably makes $7-8 million at Ole Miss right now, somewhere around there. If you're making that type of money to coach somewhere and you already have it stabilized, I think that's the best option. Because now you end up at Florida, what do they expect? Turn over the roster year one, build your culture year two, get to a bowl game, get going. It's hard to do that fast. But those are the expectations that have been created by the new age of college athletics. So he has to weigh his options pretty carefully. And for me, I'm not him, so I'm not making this decision. But I would imagine Florida's going to offer him that job. And he's going to have to be very, very meticulous about the decision he makes from that point forward. It's a tough one to make. It's a really tough one to make. I do not envy his position for the most part. You're going to leave one. If you end up leaving, you're leaving one fan base in the dust going into another one, and it's going to be really tough to win them over immediately if you don't win 8, 9, 10 games year one. So we'll see. Now, LSU, South Carolina. LSU gets over top 36-33 on the road. What I'd say to South Carolina and South Carolina fans, don't give up a 24-10 lead. That simple. But I do think the refs really screwed this one up badly.
Yeah.
I think the worst call of the game, and there were many, by the way, there was a nullified pick six and all this different stuff. Worst call of the game was the unnecessary roughness on the pick by South Carolina. It was Kennard, is one of their DNs. He hits Garrett Nussmeier once. South Carolina intercepts the ball, call him for unnecessary roughness. It gets called back all the way, nullified the whole thing. I was embarrassed for these referees this weekend, and it really shifted the way that game went. It was very frustrating to watch that game as it got to the fourth quarter. I don't think South Carolina did themselves any favors, but the refereeing in that game definitely needs to be talked about. And the issue you have with calling out referees, the best that South Carolina can do, and I think they will do this, is submit plays. Send them to the SEC officiating office and say, we think you messed this up. But the best you get in return is, yeah, we messed this up, but the outcome of the game is still the same. It's tough. It's tough to watch that for a program that I thought could have earned themselves a victory in that situation against a big SEC opponent. And it would have propelled them into the top 25, and we would have been taking them a whole lot more seriously than we're taking them on this particular Monday. I still think they're great in the trenches on both sides of the ball, but winning that game would have gone a long way. And I think the referees got in the way.
Quarterbacks are too protected.
Yep. There was a...
You should be able to get blown up
when
you're a defender.
There was a sack in the Indiana game where you had a guy just coming off the edge and sacking the quarterback. Didn't land on him. Called a roughing the passer penalty. I know Indiana rolled UCLA anyway, but that shouldn't have been a roughing the passer. You had a targeting call in the Texas A&M and Florida game that I can't. A&M receiver jumps up to catch it. Florida defender hits him in his back while he's in the air going to catch the ball, which is just a normal football play. Call him for targeting because his head was down and he was launching. I think we have gotten to the point where there's just so many subjective calls, and it's all in the eye of the beholder with these refs, and they're asked time and time again to create points of emphasis, and they're looking for things that may not be there. But if they even feel like there's a little bit of that point of emphasis as a part of a play, they're going to throw the flag. I just think they've been put in a really tough spot. I don't fully blame it directly on the officials. I blame it on the head of officials and the way that we have tied defenders' hands when they're trying to play defense, and just the way we ultimately leave most of these targeting calls and roughing the passer and unnecessary roughness. We've left all those in the eye of the beholder, and everyone has a different, you know, look, idea of what those penalties are supposed to be.
Sometimes,
and I just think these refs are in a tough spot.
I feel like sometimes the refs are reacting to the crowd response from a hit sometimes. Like, football's a violent sport. People are going to get blown up sometimes. There doesn't need to be a flag every single time. When a defender hits somebody in a football stance and just knocks their head off, it's going to happen. It's football. That's not a penalty. Defenders should be able to land on people. As long there's clear targeting moments, but just to be quite honest, most of the time when targeting is looked at or when roughing the passer is called, it's just not that.
It's tough for defenders too, because a lot of the targetings they get called for, it's just incidental.
Well,
offensive player lowers his head. They also lower their head. They get the call.
I think it may have happened in the Ball State Miami game where Ball State had a fumble. I can't remember which game it was that I was watching, but somebody had a fumble. And a defender jumped to go get the football, and the quarterback bent down to get the ball when it happened, and it was bang, bang. The defender wasn't even going for the quarterback. Hit the quarterback's helmet because he was going for the ball, targeting out of the game. It's like, what are we doing?
It's all
incidental. That's silly. It's silly.
It is.
And at some point, if you handcuff the defenders too much, it's going to become dangerous for the defenders. I really do think that. At some point, you put so many protections on it, it's going to become dangerous.
We've seen it in the past. Guys not trying to land on quarterbacks, trying to brace themselves, and they, you know, tear a labrum in the process. We've seen it in the past. It is hard to be a defender in this day and age of football in general. At the NFL level, we'll talk about that a little bit later, and at the college level. It's tough.
Sometimes people get blown up.
It's
going to happen. Stop protecting quarterbacks like this. It drives me nuts. People were like, well, it was a crackback block in the LSU. No, it wasn't.
He became a defender. He's going to go chase the play. Why can't he get blocked?
Well, his eyes weren't on the defender. Yeah, they were on the football because he was a defender, and he was going to go try to tackle the guy.
The blindside block thing is, too, something that I just can't get used to.
I've seen blindside blocks.
There's a high risk of injury, you know, head injury on illegal blindside blocks, whether it's the guy hitting you in the head or your head hitting the ground. I understand that there is a high risk of injury, brain injury on those plays.